Dumb.
Thank you, Greta. It is 6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. The debate over stem cell research has apparently become even more complex. Researchers hope to use human stem cells to develop replacement tissue for people who suffer from a wide variety of serious, debilitating diseases. But where to get the stem cells? One source has been unused human embryos donated by fertility clinics. But is that ethical? Scientists and ethicists have been involved in a lively debate over that issue, and President Bush is expected to announce soon whether federal money will be used to finance such research. The debate, meanwhile, has raised serious ethical questions, but now it's been announced that researchers at the Virginia-based Jones Institute for Reproductive Medicine have created human embryos, not for the purpose of helping people have a child, but for the specific purpose of harvesting stem cells. Today on Midday, we're going to take a closer look at this issue. We'll be opening the phone lines for your questions and comments, but first of all, we have a report on the Jones Institute announcement from National Public Radio's Joe Pelka.
Many scientists believe embryonic stem cells have the potential to revolutionize medicine. The reason is they are cells with the unique ability to turn into any kind of cell in the body, and so might someday be used to replace nerve cells or heart cells or pancreas cells destroyed or damaged by disease. But as their name suggests, most embryonic stem cells are derived from human embryos, and that prompts careful consideration.
Before I started the work, I certainly did a lot of soul-searching about what I thought was right and wrong.
James Thompson is the University of Wisconsin scientist who first successfully derived embryonic stem cells from human embryos.
In the end, in my own mind, what it came down to is that in basically all countries that have IVF clinics, embryos are frozen, the fate of those embryos is put in the hands of the couples, and embryos are routinely thrown out. To me, regardless of what you think the status of the pre-implantation embryo is, it seems to me a much better ethical choice to actually do something useful with those embryos rather than just throw them out.
But researchers at the Jones Institute, one of the first IVF clinics in the country, looked at the issue in a different way. William Gibbons, a reproductive endocrinologist at the Institute, argues that most people who create embryos as part of a fertility procedure do so because they want those embryos to become children, not so they can be used in scientific experiments. On the other hand, says Gibbons, people who are donating eggs or sperm, what scientists call gametes, and are told their gametes are only to be used for stem cell research are in a very different position.
Perhaps the clearest form of informed consent would come from a process in which the person producing the gametes knew from the very beginning that this was the intent for the utilization of those gametes. And this also then allowed for the psychological evaluation of those people that suggested that they would approve use of their gametes in that way.
So that's how the Jones Institute scientists proceeded. As they describe in the current issue of the journal Fertility and Sterility, the researchers created 40 early embryos called blastocysts using eggs and sperm donated by people who didn't know each other. Using the techniques developed by Wisconsin's James Thompson, they derived three cell lines that showed several of the characteristics of embryonic stem cells. It will take more study to prove that these cells are really embryonic stem cells. Now, the Jones Institute received no federal money for this work, so it does not fall under current prohibitions on using government money for embryo research. And for some ethicists, the Jones Institute's approach resolves some ethical questions about using embryos as a source for stem cells. The conventional way of looking at the ethical consequences of embryo research is to focus on loss or damage to the embryo.
A less conventional view focuses not on embryonic loss, but instead on the effects on already living adults.
Alta Sharo is a law professor at the University of Wisconsin who deals with questions of bioethics. She says couples who donate an embryo for research are likely to still have some emotional attachment to that embryo.
Because from their point of view, that embryo had at some point embodied a potential child. And so to obtain eggs from somebody and sperm from somebody else, where these two people are not connected, where they have no emotional relationship with one another, and where they never had any reproductive expectations from this gamete retrieval, is to ensure completely that there will be no subsequent regret. on the part of the adults whose body tissues were used to create an embryo that subsequently is destroyed in research.
But Cheryl readily acknowledges that many people will be uncomfortable with the notion of anyone creating embryos so they can be destroyed in research. Joe Pelka, NPR News, Washington.
Well, joining us now here in the studio to try to help us understand the issues involved in this debate over stem cell research, particularly this new twist in the debate, is Jeffrey Kahn, who is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Bioethics. We also invite you to join our conversation. If you have a question or comment about this research, we invite you to give us a call at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And before we get started, we want to remind you that there is a complete section on our website about this ongoing debate over stem cell research, an opportunity for you to weigh in on our website take a poll and the rest. The website address is minnesotapublicradio.org. Meanwhile, here on the radio, if you'd like to join our conversation, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Jeffrey Kahn, thanks for coming in today.
Oh, sure. Good to be here.
First of all, again, remind us what happens, absent any research, what happens to human embryos that are produced in the as a result of the fertility treatments?
Well, I think people will ask, why are there so many extras, first of all,
okay,
which I think is a fair place to start. And the answer to that is we don't know how to freeze human eggs and thaw them out for subsequent use, because that would be the real goal. So people go in who can't have children the regular way and need the help of reproductive medicine specialists, and they take the eggs from the woman and sperm from the man, and you would say, well, why don't you just save those and use them as you need to, make embryos only that you'll implant for the purpose of procreation. Well, it turns out that when you freeze a human egg and thaw it, it doesn't fertilize anymore. It doesn't work. So you have to actually make embryos. You take all the eggs that are collected, mix them up with sperm, and you make human embryos, only implant the embryos that you want to result in babies, and then freeze the rest. And what happens is, in many cases, because so many eggs are collected, so many embryos are made, that people just don't need the ones that are left over. Either they've had enough children, or they have given up trying to have children, and they don't need them anymore. So they're actually termed, believe it or not, spare embryos. That's the term of art in reproductive medicine.
Mm-hmm. And then they're discarded?
The individuals for whom they are created have to make a judgment about what should be done with them. So there are a range of options. One is to just have them remain frozen as long as you're willing to pay for the cost of that, which is just an annual cost of maintaining the laboratory freezer. So you pay a small fee. You can donate them to another couple who may need them to get pregnant. So there's sort of a possibility of adoption. But realize that there are something like 200,000 frozen human embryos worldwide by estimate. It's very hard to know the exact number, but we're talking in the hundreds of thousands of leftover embryos. They can be donated for research, as we've heard in Joe Palka's piece just before we started to talk, with the consent of the couple, or they can be discarded. That is, I don't want them to be used for any other purpose. I don't want to give them to anybody else. I don't want them to be researched upon. I want them to be destroyed. So that's the range of possibility.
Ethically speaking, what is the justification for using the embryos for research purposes, specifically stem cell research?
Well, I think we're hearing a lot about the scientific promise and the medical promise of using these cells. The cells that come from human embryos are called embryonic stem cells. And as we heard in the piece, they're cells that can become any other cell in the human body, so it could create any other kind of tissue in the human body. So the applications are for things like diabetes, where you could actually take the cells, tell them, this is the piece we don't know yet, but tell them how to become pancreatic cells, cells that make insulin in the body that people with diabetes don't have and work properly, or grow a liver for transplantation, or implant in the brain of a patient with Parkinson's disease. So there's a whole range of possible applications that we really don't understand yet, but I think scientists and physicians think are very, very promising. The problem is the source of these cells, the best source so far, is from human embryos. So the tension is between what we think the moral status of human embryos is. Are they like you and me talking to each other? Or are they like the skin that you'd scrape off the inside of your cheek, which are just sort of cells from your body, or are they something in between that deserve some different status than regular cells, but some different status than regular human beings as well? And the tensions between that, the answer to that question, and the promising science that we think can be done in the use of these cells.
And I gather there is no consensus on the status.
No, that's right. And I think it's in many ways, the answer to that question tracks to the answer to the question about abortion. Do you think it's acceptable to perform abortion? For many people, life begins at conception. For other people, it begins much later in terms of the importance of human life, maybe the status of personhood being the sort of way to draw that line. So it depends on how you answer that question. I think it doesn't exactly track to abortion because there have been some polls that have shown people who are actually against abortion support embryonic stem cell research. And what we're arguing about at the level of public policy right now is not the legality of this, but rather whether the federal government ought to spend our collective money on this research. And so we're hearing the administration sort of going back and forth about the propriety of this. And we're also hearing people who are quite staunch anti-abortion advocates in the Senate, for instance, Orrin Hatch and Trent Lott, saying, yes, I don't support abortion, but I do support embryonic stem cell research. So it doesn't exactly track to people's feelings about abortion as you might think.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't there quite the same, why doesn't it track exactly?
I don't think anybody really knows, but I would speculate, and I've talked to lots of people about this, that it's a function of seeing real benefit from the research that we're talking about. There's actually been a ban in place of federal funding for this kind of research going back to the first Reagan administration, so 1981, at a time when it didn't seem to be any great reason to do research on human embryos using federal money. So it was easy to hold up that principle as respecting the status of the human life potential embodied in a human embryo when there didn't seem to be great reasons to do that research anyway. But now we have people saying, look, I have a loved one who's got Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or diabetes. We all know somebody with a disease that could be treated by this. And we see celebrities like Christopher Reeve and Michael J. Fox and Mary Tyler Moore sitting before congressional panels and saying, this research could help me or people like me. You need to let it go forward. So it's the real people with the real disease and the real application, I think, pushing on this principle that now isn't so hard to hold up when there's pretty concrete evidence arguing for doing the research that may violate that principle.
Now, from an ethical standpoint, does this this announcement today fundamentally change the debate over stem cell research, namely that these researchers, rather than using embryos that were created for the purpose of having a child, they just created the embryos for purposes of research?
Yeah, actually, I don't think it fundamentally changes the argument ethically. It's not clear to me, first of all, why we need to do it. I mean, there are all these extra embryos, as we just have discussed, so why not use them? But if you're talking about taking an embryo and using it for research purposes, realizing that that destroys it in the process, I'm not sure from the perspective of the embryo status it matters whether they were created for that purpose or were created for some other purpose and are being used in research. That to me is not a terribly strong distinction. I think there is an argument about whether the individual from whom the gametes, the egg and the sperm come, have a different kind of vested interest in the use of that created embryo. That's true. I think that's right, but I think that goes right to the issue of informed consent. Can individuals decide what should be done to the embryos that are created for research purposes or for reproductive purposes but have no further use to them for that reason? So I don't know why we don't stake at all to the idea of consent of the people for whom they were created, whether it's for research purposes or reproduction.
Jeffrey Kahn is with us. He is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Bioethics, and he's joined us this hour to talk about the latest developments in the very interesting, very complex debate over embryonic stem cell research. The specific question before the Bush administration, of course, is whether federal funds should be used to support such research. Now, today, there is this new development, this new announcement from the Jones Institute for Reproductive Medicine that it has specifically created human embryos to use in research. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2000. 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828. Jeffrey, if the announcement from the Jones Institute, in your mind, has not fundamentally changed the ethical debate, has it changed the political debate?
Absolutely. And there was a piece in the New York Times this morning in which someone was quoted as saying, this behavior, this decision by the Jones Institute couldn't have come at a worse time. I think it does push the political debate in a way that may not be in science's best interest. So I think it depends on which side of the argument you stand on. On one side, the scientists are saying this is bad timing. They shouldn't have done this. It now forces the hand of the administration potentially in a way that won't support the research. If you're on the side that says we should respect the life that's embodied in these human embryos, and this is more evidence of why we need to be very careful about funding and allowing this kind of research, because this shows how far scientists will go if there aren't rules preventing them from doing so. Now, I think, in a bit of a twist, that the only way for us to actually get our hands around this by regulation is to fund it, to get the federal government involved in funding this research, because with federal funding comes federal control. And I think without funding, we really don't have much in the way of reach to prevent or control the kind of things that are being announced today. So the reason the Jones Institute could do this was because it's totally in the private sector, does not use any federal funding in their work, and so don't have to follow any federal rules.
Mm-hmm. If they're not using federal money, though, and say President Bush tomorrow said, okay, let's use federal money to support research, well, places like the Jones Institute could still go ahead and do whatever they wanted to, right?
They could, but the bar is raised in a pretty profound way. And that's true, actually, with all research now. The rules actually that exist say, if you take federal money, you have to follow federal rules. But if you don't take federal money, you don't have to follow federal rules. But most institutions like universities say voluntarily that it doesn't make sense for us to treat some research by one set of ethical guidelines and other research by a different set. So we apply the federal regulations to all the research that we do, whether privately or publicly funded. And so it would put a lot of pressure on the private sector to follow the same rules as the public sector. And I think that's very hard to ignore.
Before we get to our callers, I want to ask you one more question here, Jeffrey. In the darkest scenario you can imagine, or that opponents of stem cell research can imagine, where do they see this heading, the slippery slope? Where does the slippery slope lead to if something isn't done to control this research?
Well, I think actually it's not even the darkest scenario. It's sort of where does this go on the therapeutic side? So what we're talking about now is really basic science research, what these stem cells can and can't do, how we can control them, what the mechanisms are for the developmental biology that's involved. But that doesn't really get us the applications that we need. So if you needed a new liver, we would want to make one that matched your genetics as closely as possible. And so many people have suggested the best way to do that would be to actually clone you, not to make a whole new Gary, but to stop that division after a few days, take the embryonic stem cells from the clone and tell those cells to become liver that would be a genetically identical match to the one that we needed to replace. And so this is in a way a stepwise argument. We're in a sort of early stage of the science, which requires us to do certain kinds of research. But when we get to the application, we may need to do things that are actually much more controversial than just using spare embryos or embryos that we create for this purpose and actually go to what looks very much like human cloning. So I think that the opponents would say this is the slippery slope down which we go by investing in this research on the front end. We can't stop it. And if we don't think human cloning is appropriate, we should be working on this kind of stem cell research if we think there's going to be any human application down the road.
Hmm. Pamela, your question, please.
Hi. Actually, I have a comment. I'm going through in vitro fertilization right now. I lost a baby last fall due to a chromosomal problem that we didn't know we had, and we're very committed to having a child through this process. So I have a real personal, stake in research in the future, and I've already donated some embryos that came up positive for the chromosomal problem, and I plan to continue donating any extra embryos that we might have. I actually know some people who have died from diabetes, Parkinson's, and dementia, and I know two people who have had organ transplants, and losing the baby the way that we did, it just led me to a real deep level of compassion for suffering in people. And if I can do anything by donating these embryos to lower human suffering, I'm going to do it.
Okay.
You know, Pamela raises, a perspective that many people have come forward and shared, everybody from members of Congress to journalists like Morton Kondracki in Washington, whose wife has advanced Parkinson's disease, and he actually quit his job as a journalist and became a full-time advocate for Parkinson's research. I think that you're hearing the rhetoric switch a little bit, and people who have been actually on the front lines of the abortion debate have said this research, stem cell research, is pro-life. We're using that same language, and the reason we have to go forward is because it's pro-life. I think the second thing I would say about Pamela's comments is that whatever we decide, I think individuals have to be able to donate their embryos, do with them as they see fit. So whether the public funding comes through or not, people like Pamela will always be able to donate their embryos to research in the private sector. And that's part of, I think, of our individual control of our procreative lives. It goes to the sort of sense of control of our own bodies.
But what about the argument that this is fundamentally human life and that nobody has the right to take it away?
That is the perspective of people, I think, on the far right of this debate. And I think it's a perspective that we have to listen to. I don't think anybody really feels that these are cells that don't deserve, that these embryos are not entities that deserve some kind of respect. And that there isn't a moral cost in that research. There is. There is. We heard Jamie Thompson, who is one of the first people to isolate these cells, who's at the University of Wisconsin, say he had to think very hard about his own life, about whether this was an acceptable thing to do. And so I think it would be wrong to say there's no moral cost in using human embryos in research. We have to think about the moral cost weighed against the human suffering that can be avoided or prevented or taken away by this kind of research. So there's always going to be trade-offs. That's what makes these questions so difficult.
Mm-hmm. D.J. Tice in the St. Paul Pioneer Press today writes in an opinion column, if something is wrong, he asks the question, if something is wrong, is it made right by some good that results?
Well, you know, it's sort of the two wrongs making a right kind of argument, and I'm not sure that I would set it up that way. I think if you believe that it's fundamentally wrong to do anything that would harm a human embryo, then it doesn't matter how much good comes from that decision, from that research. So we have to answer that question initially, first. And there's going to be a diversity of views about answers to that question. I think that the mainstream is that we should go forward. It seems to be from all the polls. It's not sort of, you know, my word against anybody else's. The public opinion seems to be, in the main, this is acceptable kind of research, but it shouldn't be done willy-nilly and for any purpose at all. It should be done for good scientific reason and with respect for the embryos from which it comes.
Mm-hmm. Joanne, your question?
Yes, I was wondering how far, after the eggs are fertilized, how far are they allowed to divide before the embryos are frozen?
Before they're frozen?
Yeah, into the process.
Just a few days of life and a few divisions along. So this is not my area of expertise, but from what I understand, they're really only a matter of 8 or 16 or sometimes 32 cells old. That's just a few divisions from fertilization. So they're, many people call them pre-embryos. That's how early they are along in the process.
Scott, your question?
Hi, you covered this a little bit right before you took the first call, but I was curious about the applications. In trying to determine what I think about it, it kind of came down to me that if the research was successful, how would it be applied? What are the options? Is the only option basically cloning somebody and then taking the cells from the clone? Or is there, I mean, where would you get the cells to apply this technology?
That's a great question, Scott. There really are two approaches. I was sort of painting one potential application down the road. Another would be if we have these many thousands of embryos to use from that are left over to create cell lines, there's, I think, a thought that we could create libraries of embryonic stem cells that would have various characteristics, so we could match your needs with the cells that exist in a library from many tens of thousands of embryos potentially, and so we could sort of select the one that matched you best. If that were possible, then we wouldn't need to make clones. We just would be able to choose from the embryos, the cell lines that are created from embryos that have already existed. I think it's too early to know whether that's possible or not. There's also, I think, every possibility that science will advance to the stage that we don't need to have such close genetic matching that will be able to do something to the cells to make them more immunologically universal. So we won't need to be so careful about the immune system match, given new drugs or new techniques that we can use to actually alter the cells themselves. So the research will actually lead to answers to the question that you raise.
Jeffrey Kahn is with us. He is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Bioethics, and he's come by today to help us understand the latest twists in the continuing debate over stem cell research. The president is trying to decide whether federal funding can be used to support that research. Today there is yet another twist to the debate. Virginia-based Jones Institute for Reproductive Medicine announcing that it has been creating human embryos not for the purpose of having a child, as fertility clinics do, but for the specific purpose of harvesting stem cells. If you'd like to join our conversation here about these developments, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We will also, we should also remind you that there is lots more information about this subject on our website, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. We'll get to more of your questions in just a couple of minutes.
If you're a fan of the Minnesota Fringe Festival, you're in luck. Minnesota Public Radio listeners can receive a free pass to one opening weekend Fringe show. Fringe is a quirky and creative celebration of live stage performance, including theater, dance, puppetry, spoken word storytelling, and much, much more. Opening weekend is August 3rd at venues around Minneapolis. For your free pass, call Member Listener Services right now at 651-290-1212.
Good news about the Fringe Festival. Bad news, though, for those of you who are hoping to see Daniel Shore this week, National Public Radio senior news analyst, was scheduled to be in the Twin Cities for an appearance at the Fitzgerald Theater tomorrow night. That had to be canceled, but we're hoping to reschedule that appearance by Daniel Shore sometime this fall. So our apologies and invitation to keep your ear to the ground. We'll let you know if we can get that rescheduled. Your membership in Minnesota Public Radio helps pay for the news that you rely on every day. We thank you for your continued support. Greta Cunningham joins us now with some headlines. Greta.
Thanks, Gary. Good morning. President Bush is warning GOP leaders on Capitol Hill that he will veto spending bills that he thinks are excessive. Bush held a meeting this morning with Republican leaders. Some Republicans say Bush is too focused on patients' rights, funding for religious charities, and trade. Firefighters in Washington state are regrouping for a fresh attack against a deadly fire in the northern Cascade Mountains. Hundreds of firefighters have been called in to help battle the 2,500-acre blaze, which killed four firefighters and injured four others. Former Kansas Senator and presidential candidate Bob Dole is back in the hospital. Dole has developed an infection following surgery late last month to treat an aneurysm. Dole is 77 years old. He's expected to be discharged from a Washington hospital today or tomorrow. In regional news, government and relief officials are meeting today in Albert Lea to discuss options for those affected by the Farmland Foods plant fire. Authorities say the fire was started when sparks from a welder ignited boxes inside a storage building. The fire started Sunday afternoon and destroyed about half of the plant before it was contained Monday evening. So far, about 250 plant employees have signed up for unemployment benefits. Minneapolis police are investigating a pair of deaths. An autopsy is planned on the body of a man whose body was found late last night in a car in North Minneapolis. Police say the man appeared to have been shot multiple times. His name is being withheld until relatives are notified. No arrests have been made. Police are also investigating the discovery of a man's body along a Mississippi River bluff near downtown Minneapolis. Three men walking on the West River Parkway discovered the body yesterday. The death is considered suspicious and is being investigated as a possible homicide. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for partly sunny skies statewide. High temperatures today ranging from 75 to 85 degrees. Right now in Thief River Falls, it's cloudy and 70. Moorhead reports fair skies and 73. Cloudy skies in Hibbing and 71. It's sunny in Worthington and 75. And in the Twin Cities, sunshine with a temperature of 75. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. 25 minutes before noon. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Jeffrey Kahn has joined us. He is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Bioethics. He's here today to help us understand some of the latest developments in the continuing debate, the complex debate over the use of human embryos for stem cell research. There is now a new development in that story. As we noted earlier, the Jones Institute announced that it has been creating embryos specifically for the purpose of research, as opposed to using embryos that were created as a consequence of fertility treatments. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. I know earlier, Jeffrey, you said that from an ethical standpoint, you didn't think that today's announcement from the Jones Institute materially changed the debate politically, big impact perhaps, but not ethically. I'm wondering, does it make any difference? I was reading that only three of the 110 fertilized eggs that the Jones Institute produced, only three of them ever produced any kind of stem cells. Is that kind of inefficiency affect consideration, ethical considerations of what's going on?
That's actually a good point. And you know, the science will improve as this work goes forward. Certainly, part of the problem will be getting enough embryos to do this kind of research. Where will they come from if it's only 3 in 100? It's a 3% efficiency rate. I think that's an issue to consider. Is that an acceptably high, is that high enough, is efficiency to justify this kind of work? But we can't really do any better until we do more research. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem. I should say, too, in answer to your previous question and comment, I think for some people the intention under which the embryos were created does matter. So if it was the intention to make embryos for the purpose of having a child and they're left over, the fact that you created them for the purpose of procreation makes it a more acceptable reason to have generated the embryos in the first place than doing it merely for the purpose of research, which would end up in destroying that embryo. So if you can hang enough on that distinction, then, and that's an important one, then I think that you can say that there is an argument about what the Jones Institute said they did today is less ethically acceptable than using what are so-called spare embryos. I think that's a pretty thin read myself. But that's where many people have said the distinction is important, and why what the Jones people did is less acceptable than using spare embryos.
Mm-hmm. Chris, your question, please.
Yes. Currently, it sounds like individuals have an option of donating spare embryos for research. I guess I have a problem with the fact that companies will profit hugely from research with embryos that have all been donated by individuals in the interest of science and not of profit. In the future, will individuals be able to sell embryos for research and eliminate this double standard?
Chris, you raise a really interesting question. And there's experience, actually, an answer to this, not from the use of human embryos, but from other tissue that come from patients. The most famous case being one against the University of California, Los Angeles, happens to be my alma mater. I have no connection with this case, but I went there for college, where a man named Edward Moore came for treatment there for something called hairy cell leukemia. It turned out that the particular cells that made up that leukemia, which he was cured of, by the way, in the treatment, ended up in a very profitable cell line having been created by researchers who took the tissue from his body, did a bunch of work to it, certainly spent a lot of their intellectual resources and laboratory effort to create the cell line, but then made many hundreds of millions of dollars for themselves and for the University of California from the sale of that cell line. And so Mr. Moore said it wasn't fair that the material came from his body, yet he didn't share in any of the proceeds. It turns out that the courts in California said, you know, they should have told you that they were doing this research, because they asked him to come back and give some more blood and other samples in support of the research without telling him why. But he didn't really have any property claim in the what ended up to be the commercializable product that came from his disease. So I think the same kind of standard would be applied here. I don't think we're ever going to see the day when you can actually get paid for your human embryos. That would be effectively trade in human, either human parts or human tissue, which is actually illegal under federal law. You may not sell human organs under something called the National Organ Transplant Act, which really was created to prevent people from selling their kidneys and other body parts, but I think would apply here as well.
Mm-hmm. Not to get too far off track, but very briefly, why does that seem to be illegal? What would be wrong with that?
The concern is twofold. One is that everybody has a price, And so it would be too easy to exploit people who needed money. If I were to say to you, you know, maybe $10,000 isn't enough, but $100,000 is, will you give me your kidney? That would take advantage of your willingness to pay, to take money for something that might be very risky. And the second reason is that it doesn't allocate them in a fair way. So if we allowed people to spend their money, those who had more money would have better access to organs that might save their lives. And we don't allocate health resources in that way.
I see. Terry, your question, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to this thing of calling these 16, 32-cell clusters pre-embryos. I think in animal science, plant science, any place else, a fertilized egg would be considered an embryo. And the use of pre-embryo, and I think the other term is blastosphere or something like that, is really a pro-abortion smokescreen to, you know, to cover up that this really is an embryo. In your discussion here, every time you refer to this thing, you refer to it as an embryo. It's called embryo stem cells. It's not called pre-embryo stem cells. It's, you know, this is a semantical cover-up of what really you're talking about.
Okay.
You know, Terry, the terms are actually come from the biologists. You know, blastocyst is actually the biology term for fertilized egg that has advanced to a certain point. And then when it goes a little further, it's called something else. I happen to agree with you. I don't think we should mince words here. And once it's a fertilized egg, it's certainly on the path to becoming a human being. At what point do we think it's important that we don't touch it? I mean, that's really the question. Whether you call it a blastocyst or a pre-embryo doesn't really matter so much as trying to figure out at what point, if any, it's acceptable to use these things in research. So I don't know that we're fooling anybody by using different words, and I think everybody seems to understand that what we're talking about are fertilized human eggs that are otherwise used to create children.
Jennifer, your question?
Yes, my question is, or comment rather, is from what I understand from reading about this research, is that scientists could use adult stem cells, and that the reason that they choose to use the, or they want to, is the quantity and the easy accessibility of the embryos. I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
Jeffrey?
You know, Jennifer, you raise a very good point, and there has been a lot of talk about the use of adult stem cells versus embryonic stem cells. I think that there are significant differences. This is not an area in which I have any expertise, but one of my colleagues at the university named Catherine Verfai, who directs the Stem Cell Institute, actually does her own work in the area of adult stem cell research. Those are cells that exist in all of our bodies. Think of the bone marrow, which is a good example. The bone marrow has stem cells in it that can become any other kind of cell in the blood supply, but we don't know whether they can become any other kind of cell in the human body. That is not at all clear yet. Catherine Verfai's work is actually trying to determine that, and she will tell you that while her work is on adult stem cells, she thinks we have to also do research on embryonic stem cells because we don't really understand whether those cells are equally good. The consensus at the moment in science is that embryonic stem cells have more plasticity or more potency to become any other kind of cell in the body than do adult stem cells. But we won't know that unless we do research on both kinds of cells. So I think it's really important to make that distinction. And no one wants to use embryonic stem cells if we can get just as much research and a potential therapeutic use out of adult stem cells. But we just don't know that that's the case yet.
Mm-hmm. Anna, your question?
Yes, I'd like to have the professor answer the question about the idea of human experimentation, after the Nuremberg trials and the experimentations in the Nazi regime, there were a rule set up about experimenting on humans. And one of the issues was to do the research in animal models. Most research is done in animal models long before they try to do them on humans. And this seems to be a push to get a human experimental animal that's, you know, accepted as a not having no value. And isn't this really just so that the scientists can have a human experimental model that they don't have to go through rules as they do in other human experimentation?
Anna, you're right to point out that there are very strict rules about the use of humans in research. I think in answer to your question, the answer is no. There's actually lots and lots and lots and lots of work done at the animal level over the course of many years, the mouse being the most prominent model. But I think there's every indication that we can't learn everything from animal models. We know that from other kinds of biomedical research, and we have to, at some point, if we're going to do human application, use humans in research. Now, these are, I mean, it's arguable about whether these are even humans, what their status is. And the Nuremberg Code, which is actually not a binding international code after all, but the regulations in the U.S. are quite strong on this topic as well, require there to be either consent of the individual or, in the case of people who cannot consent for themselves, consent by proxy. So in the case of minor children, parents are required to give consent. There actually are rules on the books that say you cannot do research on human embryos with federal money. It's not allowed. You can do research on human embryos if you follow certain rules about going through institutional review boards. So bodies that sit at universities like the University of Minnesota and every other place that research is done that prospectively review research before it can go forward, whether it involves human tissue or people like you and me talking to each other. So I think there's lots and lots and lots of oversight and rules and, in a way, obstacles to research going forward without full ethical review. That does not happen, I can assure you. And it should not happen. Anna is absolutely right that would be inappropriate. And so I don't think anybody is actually trying to circumvent any rules and create models without going through animals first.
Claudia, you're next. Your question, please.
Thank you. I don't know if this question's been asked before. I haven't been able to listen to the whole program. But for those who object to the use of these embryos or whatever they're called for this purpose, what is their position, do you know, on what should be done with them? Do they also object with the people who donated the egg and the sperm to make these, that they don't have the right to have them destroyed? Do they think they should be required to pay for the maintenance of them forever? I mean, what's to be done with them? And secondly, and maybe this isn't a question for you, but were they objecting to this procedure when it first started for in vitro fertilization to begin with?
There is a certain group of people who don't believe that we should be doing in vitro fertilization, that it's in a way tampering with procreation that's not ours to do. It's God's work and not human work to decide which children should be made and when. So I think if you take that tack, then none of this is acceptable, whether it's reproductive medicine or research of the sort we're discussing today. I think in terms of answering your first question, Claudia, about what should be done, the most conservative view is to say they should remain frozen because that way they're not destroyed. Whether you're going to use them or not, the most respectful thing is to allow them to remain frozen or for them to be adopted and implanted in the womb of another woman and have them brought into the world as a child. So those are the two options that would be acceptable. A donation for research would not be acceptable because it would destroy them, nor would discarding them for the same reason. So it's just a more limited range of possible uses of the embryos that are left over after reproductive medicine uses. And I think in terms of people coming forward and donating their gametes for creation of embryos for research, they would say that that's not an acceptable thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Are there many of these embryos that are used in that adoption sense that you're talking about? Does that actually happen?
It happens, but it's a very small number that it happens for. And you think about, it requires somebody willing to have an embryo implanted into their uterus, a woman saying, I will carry this embryo if it develops into a fetus and go to term and deliver that baby. Most people wouldn't want to go that route. They would prefer to have a biologically related child. So I think it's only many steps down the path in terms of failed attempts at having children that they would even consider that. So it's a vanishingly small proportion that ever end up being used that way.
Mm-hmm. Gary, quick question here before we wrap up.
Yeah, good morning. I was wondering what you perceive the worldwide interest level in developing military weapons based on stem cell research.
I don't know enough about the possibilities to even comment. Maybe there are some kind of biological warfare applications, but to be honest, I really don't know any, and I don't know enough about it to even comment. I'm sorry.
Is the debate over this issue well-informed, do you think, the general public debate and the debate among the experts, or are people kind of feeling their way along trying to come up with some some framework, some principles?
I think actually there's been so much coverage in the last weeks and months that there's, a pretty good understanding at the public level of what's at stake. I think, unfortunately, the debate has been much too informed by political considerations and too little informed by science and ethics. And I think we're going down a path where the finger's, you know, sort of in the wind, and we're trying to figure out which way the political winds are blowing, and the administration's trying to decide how to offend the least number of people in this decision about funding research on embryonic stem cells. So I don't think the right people are being included in the conversation in terms of the decision-making at the level of the Bush administration. And I've heard that actually from numbers of people. They're very frustrated that the decisions seem to be being driven by political rather than the moral and scientific considerations. I think having conversations like this are very helpful in bringing out what the issues really are. And I think actually what we're arguing about is a bit of a halfway technology, because as we said earlier on, therapeutic applications will require us to have some quite different decisions. It's not just about whether we use leftover embryos, but potentially even whether we make embryos that have specific characteristics for the purpose of stem cells to save people's lives or improve their health. So this is an ongoing debate that won't be solved by whatever George W. Bush decides in the next days or weeks.
Mm-hmm. You were saying earlier that one thing that differentiates this this debate somewhat from the abortion debate is that it seems it's less of a theoretical debate. Everybody knows somebody who has one of these horrible diseases. I would think if you move further down that road, and then if you knew for a fact that the scientists could come up with a cure, and it's not just theoretical, I would think the pressures would be immense to open the floodgates, would they not?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think actually the pressures are already immense to open the floodgates. I think that's what we're seeing happening not only from the scientific community and the patient advocacy, sort of disease-specific advocacy movements around diabetes and cancer and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, but also when we hear very prominent politicians stand up and say we should fund this research. And I already mentioned Orrin Hatch has been very outspoken on this. But we've also seen members of the House of Representatives on the Republican side saying, you know what, we want to provide some cover on the other side of the debate, and have said not only is this unethical research, it's illegal research, and have signed a letter to that effect, sent it to the Bush administration saying, we support your decision not to let this go forward. So I think we're seeing lines being very clearly drawn. It's, I think, going to be very interesting to watch how this all unfolds. If you would ask me a month ago where I thought it was going, I would have said, I think that the pressure is mounting in a sort of insurmountable way. They're not going to be able to say no, that they'll have to figure out a way to fund this at some level. But now I'm not so sure. And I think that the announcement by the Jones Institute really adds fuel to the fire on the side that will say, we can't support this, because look where people will go if we do.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Good information. Jeffrey Kahn, who is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Bioethics, joining us this hour to help us understand some of the latest twists and turns in the continuing debate over stem cell research. As we've been saying, President Bush is confronting a big decision as to whether to authorize the use of federal funding for such research. Website, lots of information about this issue on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. Make sure you check out the information. We have poll information, and also get up on the soapbox and share your opinions.
Minnesota Public Radio would like to say a big thank you to all of our members for the successful June membership drive. Join us for an evening with the Minnesota Orchestra, Saturday night, July 28th at 8 o'clock, in a program featuring the works of American composers John Adams, Richard Rodgers, and even Elvis. MPR members will get a 20% discount on tickets. To order yours, call the Orchestra Hall box office at 1-800-292-4141 and have your MPR member number handy.
5 minutes now before 12 o'clock.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 11th of July, 2001. It's the birthday of critic Harold Bloom, born in New York City, 1930, son of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. Harold Bloom's first language was Yiddish, taught himself to read English before he was 5 years old. He's taught for almost 40 years at Yale University, where he's Sterling Professor of Humanities. His book, The Western Canon, in 1994, contained his list of the most important books and authors of Western literature. In his early books, Shelley's Mythmaking and The Visionary Company, he bucked the prevailing academic view by saying that Romanticism was the central tradition of English poetry and a continuing force in literature. It's the birthday of the tenor Nikolai Gedda, born in Stockholm, Sweden, 1925. In his long career, sang in all the major opera houses and was renowned for his recitals of German Lieder. It's the birthday of E.B. White, Elwin Brooks White, born in Mount Vernon, New York, 1899. One of the first writers that Harold Ross hired for the New Yorker magazine. Wrote essays, poems, sketches, stories, and at least one cartoon caption for the magazine, I Say It's Spinach and I Say the Hell With It. It was on this day in 1804, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton met to fight a duel early in the morning on the heights of Weehawken, New Jersey. They had been political enemies for years, and when Burr heard that Hamilton had called him a dangerous man and said he had a still more despicable opinion of him, Burr challenged him to a duel. Hamilton was opposed to the idea of dueling, but he felt compelled as a matter of honor to accept the challenge, and they met, pistols in hand, on the very place where Hamilton's oldest son had died in a duel 3 years before. Hamilton fired first into the air, deliberately missing Burr, who then took careful aim, pulled the trigger, and killed Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton left a wife and 7 children deeply in debt, and the public career of Aaron Burr was forever ruined. And it's the birthday of John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams, John Quincy, the 6th President of the United States, born in Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1767. Though he described himself as reserved, cold, austere, forbidding, a gloomy misanthrope, he was the most skilled and successful diplomat of his time, serving the government of George Washington in Europe, though his presidency is generally considered a political failure. After his presidency, he was elected to the House of Representatives, and some people suggested that he was degrading the presidency thereby. John Quincy Adams said, no man could be degraded by serving the people, either as a representative of Congress or as a town selectman. Here's a poem for today by Michael S. Harper, entitled, Makin' Jump Shots. He waltzes into the lane, across the free throw line, fakes a drive, pivots, floats from the asphalt turf in an arc of black light, and sinks two into the chains. One-on-one, he fakes down the main, passes into the free lane, and hits the chains. A sniff in the fallen air, he stuffs it through the chains, riding high, traveling, someone calls, and he laughs, stepping to a silent beat, gliding as he sinks two into the chains. A poem by Michael S. Harper, Makin' Jump Shots, from Images of Kin, New and Selected Poems, published by the University of Illinois Press. Used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the people at 21NorthMaine.com, where book lovers find millions of gently read classics, bestsellers, and rare masterpieces. On the web at 21NorthMaine.com. Research by Andrew Moore. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.